Nobody likes to lose money, and everybody likes to find the best, most efficient way to grow their wealth, right? We all have different goals that we are reaching for. And today we are here because we're sharing that like mind, right? We want to know, should we transition from stocks to real estate? Is that the best move to take us to where we want to go and everything? And I'm going to just say that this, I alluded to it already, but I want to say thank you. One of my investors was transparent with me and said in a message like, hey, Julie, you know, do you really think that this is the way to go? Because I'm ready to move a lot of funds over into real estate, but I'm just getting into this. Is this really the best move? And I obviously have my opinions on this. And I always think it's always best to bring in people who have a strong proof of concept that you share like mind with and that are role models, which is why I've invited Steve Breton here to join us. And Steve has been a powerful mentor in my life, a role model and a friend, partner as well. So I just want to say thank you to Steve for putting together this powerful slide deck to let us see behind the scenes. If you are just joining us, I just want to give that reminder, please make sure that you are on mute. This is, you know, things do happen. So hit that mute button and save your questions. We will have time for questions at the end. But I don't want to waste any ounce of time because Steve has so much valuable information to share. I'm sorry, one last reminder, if you'd like to drop your information in the chat box so that you can connect up with other people here, you are welcome to do that. And if you have questions along the way, feel free, drop those questions along the way, and we can reach, you know, like touch on those questions at the end, but you'll have that question offloaded off your mind so you can be fully present. All right, Steve, I'm turning this over to you.
Okay, so nice to see everybody online here. I'm going to go ahead and just bring up the slide presentation and we'll dive right in. Let me know when you can see the slides. What's going on here? Okay. Can you see the deck at this point?
Looks fantastic.
Okay. And let's get back to this view. Okay. So from stocks to real estate for early retirement. This has been, you know, or this is a summation of my journey from being in the stock market 100%, 401k. I worked for a financial firm for 8 years, 9 years in my early days. Learned a ton from them about how to work the stock market and how to like save and invest and followed all their advice, you know, hold through all the tough times. And, I went down that path. You'll see the results. And then I switched to real estate and now I'm semi-retired early. So that's the path that you're about to see. Let's jump into that. So quickly, first is a disclaimer. Not investment advice. That's the number one thing that you need to take from this slide. I am biased. I love real estate. I've made it now a life of it. So you have to take that into consideration when you hear all the things that I say about it. Absolutely check with your own financial advisors, your tax advisors, et cetera. So quickly, a bit about me. I'll leave the stuff up on the screen here. I think the high level is, worked for 25 years, banking, biotech, put all my money in a 401k, did all the right things, eventually started to manage my own portfolio of small properties, duplexes, triplexes. And then I founded a company, a real estate investment company called Velocity Capital in 2017. And you can see here the three bullets of all that I've done within that business over the last, 5 years in now. And then I also do a bit of volunteering because I have a lot of more time on my hands these days. So starting at 2011, I won't take you all the way back, but in 2011, I started considering real estate. And it was right after realizing that this sort of sit through that dip, sit through the 30% decline after the global, great financial crisis or whatever they call it, the GFC in 2008. And I'm thinking to myself, will I ever be ready to retire? And I'm seeing all these ads popping up, right, on TV or on the internet. And the answer for me was clearly 100% no. Like, my savings are all in 401k. They've gotten destroyed. And it's been several years now, and it's still not looking good. So I was determined to go and find diversification. The diversification I had at the time was various stocks and bonds in the stock market, with a Fidelity account and with my IRA or my 401k. Again, just following the advice of my investment advisor. But it wasn't diversified across different types of investments. I didn't have any real estate at the time. I didn't have any gold. I didn't have, whatever, anything else that you can invest in that's not your mainstream investment. So I wanted some immediate cash flows as well. I was starting to realize that the money in the 401k can only be touched when you turn 67 in my case. And I didn't want to wait another 30 years before I could actually get some of that cash flow. I wanted the extra cash flow now to help pay for my kids' college tuition and just have a better lifestyle now. Tax advantages, et cetera. So here's the stock market. And this chart's a little bit old. It's I think it goes through like middle of 2021. But in 1993, I graduated college, started investing, saved up some money. Didn't have a ton of money, obviously, in the first few years here, but I was investing like crazy. And then we hit the dot-com bubble and the market crashed. And then, I held on through that. And then it took a few years and it came back to 2008. And then it crashed again. And then it took a while and it finally came back again in 2013, which you can see here. This is called the lost decade. You can look that up and if you're not familiar with stock market returns and such, but it's basically 13 years of the stock market being at the same level. So when I started to realize this in that 2011-2012 timeframe, I'm thinking to myself, what's the point of me sitting through another one of these things and just having my investments go sideways forever, from a long-term perspective? Now, of course, you can see what happened after that, right? They started printing money like crazy, and the stock market went up a nice 12% on average from that period forward. So I could have missed out on some substantial gains had I just stayed in the stock market. You can also see here, so the last 5 years, the stock market has actually done 18% annualized. A lot of that came in the last year or so, again, with all the money printing, but that's a really nice annualized percentage. And you can see it here. I think I pulled this off yesterday on Yahoo Finance, perhaps. 5 years for the S&P 500, you've got a total of, 90%. So you're just simply dividing that by the five gets you to 18. Not exact math, I get it. And we're not talking compounded and all that stuff, but generally we're looking at 18% return. So my real estate portfolio, which I started with my own properties and then started investing with other people in multifamily, and a lot of that was passive. Majority of it was passive investments. I wasn't landlording all of this stuff. That portfolio from around the same time frame, right about here to now, was hitting above 25%. That's with all the different sales we had, reinvesting our money and going after higher level properties. And that 25% is very tax advantaged. I would say we paid maybe 15% tax rate across the board on all the sales for those properties. And more recently, I pay a bit less just because I'm better at the real estate investment game. And then this here does not account for this last leg up in the past year or two. The last property we sold, we got a 53% annualized return over 3 years. So, that's starting to take account of the huge amount of money printing that's happened and the valuation. So if we sold everything right now, which is, today's valuation, we'd be north of 30% easily on an average annualized return. So just, it's a massive difference between what you can achieve in private real estate versus the stock market. Again, a little bit biased, but biased because of my experience. So this is also just talking about the lost decade as well, you could see the U.S. large caps in that 13-year period was negative too. You know, from whatever, I forget the timing of this exact chart. You can go to a Patton Fund's lost decade here to see this chart and the description behind it. But you can see, you know, mid caps did okay, small caps not. You know, they all grew to some degree, but the large caps, which is what makes up the S&P 500 for the most part, is negative. And then you can see real estate in here at you know, this 147. Again, you have to divide this by the 10 years or 12 years or whatever. Gold did the best, but now gold has suffered for a long time as well. So, you know, you can't just pick one winner. You should be diversified across, you know, a bit of all of this stuff. So, what were my options when I was going into real estate? So I figured I'd put together just a quick chart on, you've got risk here. So the higher the bubble is up in this chart is the more risk. And then the timeline over here. So the longer you stay into something or the longer it takes for something to actually deliver the returns. And then the size of the bubble is the amount of return, sort of the percentage gains that you can get. And then you have the color being how passive the investment is. So if you think about flipping houses, that's one way to invest in real estate. It's not really an investment. It's more like a job, but people call it investing. It's very active. So it's darker. It's not light like lending. Lending is passive. You just put your money out there and it works for you. So that's the difference between passive and active income on this chart. And so flipping is you know, you've got some gains there. It's very difficult to make good money at flipping. There's a lot of competition. It's a shorter time frame, right? So it's on the left side of the axis here. It's a bit risky unless you really know what you're doing. And then you know, you've got another one like Bitcoin, top right, crazy amount of risk. You can make a ton of money, right? A huge bubble here, ton of money you can make in a short time frame. So just to give a sense of kind of, you know, how this risk timeline plays out. So building, if you build something on entitled land, so basically the county or the city says you can build, that's kind of in the middle of the chart here. It's a little bit higher on the risk profile.
I'm going to try to go to the bathroom there. Out of the way.
Sorry.
Please go ahead and make sure you are on. Go to the bathroom.
And then you've got, you know, even riskier is developed on something that's not zoned, that doesn't have approval, doesn't have the permits yet. All of this stuff is questionable. You might be able to make more money there, but at the same time, you've got a lot of questions, and with questions come risk and the potential to lose money as well. So you've got to kind of look at where you are in that building cycle. So flipping is doing work on existing housing. Building is building that housing where you have the ability to do so. And development is buying land and hoping that you can do those things if you haven't gone through zoning and approvals yet. So it gets more risky, but also gets more attractive in terms of returns. And then you have you know, buy and hold. So this is buying a duplex. That's going to take you some time to get those returns because you're waiting for your mortgage to be depreciated by inflation. You're waiting for, you know, just the property value to grow along with the rest of the single family housing stock. And then the two most passive are lending and private equity. And what we're going to talk about mostly today is private equity, which is investing in or alongside of somebody else who's buying like a large multifamily property. And we'll kind of define that and talk about that for a bit. This is a chart from the cash flow, or it's called the cash flow quadrant from Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That's a book that everyone should read and have your kids read it as well. So what this is saying is you can be an employee, you can be self-employed, which gives you a bit more freedom, and maybe you can make a bit more money doing so if you're a hard worker. You can be a business owner, right? Which is nice because now you've got other people working for you, or you can be an investor, which means you just have your money working for you. And it's a logical flow here. A lot of people, you know, you might skip a step. You might never be self-employed. Or you might go, you know, straight from employee until you're 67 years old, you retire, and now you're relying on your investments. So, you know, you could skip around for sure. But when I started this journey, I was 95% employed and 5% of my income came from investments. You know, it probably even less than that. It may have been like 1 or 2% in the stock market in the form of dividends. And I'll show you later where that ended up. So quickly here on private equity real estate. So what is it exactly? So it's called the syndication, and you could certainly read this pooling of money definition, but it's basically someone like me, someone like Julie, buying a property, typically buying this property, a multifamily property, larger property in the South, where the economy is growing, where jobs are growing, where it's business friendly, et cetera. They buy it in an LLC or an entity, and the only purpose for that entity is to hold the property. The investors, the limited partners, they put their money in as passive investors, and then they get the cash flows from that property, and they also get the appreciation at the end when we sell it. The bank also lends to that entity. And then again, you've got your sponsor here at the top that's managing the entity. So you're literally, again, investing alongside with somebody who does this for a living. And the way that it differs from a REIT is REITs are generally public. You can get it through your IRA or your 401k account. Sometimes you can get it through your Fidelity brokerage account, but they typically return like 6 or 7%. There's a high level of fees there. So it's just a bit different investment. That could be like a whole slide on itself, just the difference between the two. And we can come back to all of this stuff or any one of these slides during the questions later. So most of the time when you see a multifamily private offering or private equity, what they're doing is called a value-add deal or the value-add strategy. And the reason for this is because the value of a commercial property, when I say commercial, it's a multifamily above 5 units. The value of that property is based on net operating income. So when you acquire the property, you do some repositioning, which is also doing the maintenance that needs to be done on that property, perhaps renovating units, recoding the parking lot, fixing the roofs, making it look better, et cetera. You can substantially increase the value of the property. You can refinance. You can continue to cash flow, and eventually you sell at a higher profit. So just to give people an example of how this works, if you have the ability to raise rents in your units by $100 for 100 units times 12 months, that's $120,000 worth of income. And these properties typically trade at 20 times income, right? Net operating income. So if you do that math, 20 times $120,000, it's $2.4 million in appreciation. So you've now forced equity or forced appreciation of $2.4 million. And it doesn't matter if the single family real estate market crashes and home values are down 20% across the country or whatever. That makes no difference to multifamily. In 2008, that's what happened, right? Home prices got slammed. Multifamily prices barely budged. They didn't really see much of an impact because they still were getting their rents for the most part. And they were still doing this 20 times multiple, right? And these numbers might shift slightly, but generally this is how it works. I have a property in San Antonio right now. So for real numbers, 340 units, $200 in rent bumps times 12 for 12 months. That's $816,000 in net operating income. And if you in San Antonio, it's not 20 times, it's 25 times your operating income. So that's basically a $20 million value add on a $68 million property. So just, again, massive gains that you can force in these investments. So let's talk about my journey very quickly here of what did that look like? I say quick, it's kind of funny because the next slide is going to build and it takes a while to really see what we've done here. But so I transitioned. So I have my investments here in traditional investments. And those started off like this was my net worth. and it dwindled down drastically in terms of how much of it was in traditional investments until 2020, when COVID hit. I started to go back heavily into the market because I knew it was going to be temporary. But that's trading. It's not investing. It's a bit riskier thing to do, but I couldn't help myself. Okay. So jumping into real estate, the very first thing I did was go and buy a duplex represented by this first little bubble over here. And I was scared to death, did it anyway, figured it out. I was handy. I was self-managing everything because in Boston, the prices are very expensive. So it's hard to make a profit if you're not doing it yourself. I bought another duplex, a triplex, et cetera. So, a handful of buy and hold properties. I eventually bought a 6-unit. This should be more like 2016, but I did buy that 6-unit. Along the way, though, when I was buying these small properties, the prices kept rising in Boston, became more and more difficult to make something work. So I ended up doing a couple of flips, which I realized I didn't like. What I liked was putting my money to work with people who did flips. So I found the guys that were outbidding me at the auctions, that were outbidding me in terms of getting the best contractors to work for them. And I said, okay, you clearly know what you're doing. Let me invest alongside of you. So if you need funding for your flip, let me know. So I did make some loans, again, in light gray, because that's passive investing. I also invested in some multifamily alongside of a few people that I knew, or two people that I knew back here, back in end of 2013. And what ended up happening was this light bulb came on. Right around 2015, both of these properties sold, right? And it was a huge profit. And I was thinking to myself, if I'm making this much as a passive investor, how much are you making? And so I had conversations with the guys that I was investing alongside of, and they were showing me these huge profit margins, just like what I was just showing you as far as forcing appreciation, et cetera. And I said, well, I want more of that. And I also was thinking, why would I want to put money into my 401k when I could potentially even retire early if I plowed all of my money into these passive investments in real estate? Again, if I talked to my financial planner about this, they would have said, this is not a smart idea, right? You don't want to put all of your money into one basket. I did it anyway because I had experience with multifamily and I was very comfortable with it. You can judge that for yourselves. Maybe it's not the best thing to do, but certainly putting some money in would have been a fantastic result for me either way. So what did I do? I sold my properties. I stopped putting money into my 401k. And I took the money out of my brokerage account, my non-401k brokerage account, and I started investing like crazy over a few years into a total of 15 passive investments. Oh, sorry. This is an oil deal that I did as well. So I was just dabbling with trying to diversify my portfolio. A little bit of money here, not a lot, but it was also a passive investment. It's doing pretty well right now. Okay, so at the end of these 15, I said, again, why wouldn't I just be the sponsor? I know real estate. I've got a lot of experience. So I tried sponsoring with one of these. I partnered with a friend of mine. I was actually telling everyone I knew during this period here in the middle that they should invest in these real estate properties with me. And that was, telling my friends because I wanted them to also have some hope of being able to retire. I wanted them to have that cash flow now. And just share the wealth, what I was learning along the way. And so a bunch of them did jump right in. And it was, sometime in, it was actually in 2017, where one of my partners said, you've got a lot of friends investing, why don't you just co-partner with us? And so I went and did due diligence on a property and we learned, everything about that property and how much money it was going to make. And I felt really comfortable. So I again shared it with a lot of friends. But now I was, really trying to attract them a bit more and saying, hey, you really need to get into this. And I'm actually a partner on it. I'll be in it behind the scenes. I can see everything that's going on. Friends that trusted me jumped right in. And those properties also sold the first few. They've all done very well. And I just kept going at it. 14 sponsored deals later. We're on our 14th now. I also, along the way, did where I was partnering with somebody who was a developer in Boston. And I did some condo conversions, condo development ground up, and I did some loan originations. So instead of me lending like I did up here to fix and flippers, here I lent to a couple of construction guys who were, they were, you know, developing some properties. Down here, I actually raised the money and did the loan myself. So I originated the loan, $1 million loan for development here in Boston. And now we're working on Velocity equity funds, which is our latest offerings. And that's more along the lines of the multifamily properties in Texas and Atlanta. So that's sort of the path. So in the end, I went from, I'm never going to be able to retire in 2013 to I will retire if I invest in real estate, to I'm going to retire early because I invest in real estate. And by 2019, I actually did retire early. And I say, I call it retiring in my work because I still work 20 hours a week, but I'm making a lot more money and I have a lot more flexibility and freedom than I have ever had. And from 2020 on, I stopped focusing on myself. And I really started focusing more about how do I help others retire early? So I do some coaching. I get involved in a lot of different deals with people that are a bit newer at this, help guide them through it. I'll act as a key principal or loan guarantor for them. And also other good things, meaning the different charities that I'm involved with. So that's the general path there. Next part of the presentation is more about, you know, what does this look like now in 2022? Would I follow the same path? You know, what are some of the concerns that we might have? People worried about inflation, worried about interest rates going up. So this slide will also build. It's a lot of text. Basically, just kind of my thoughts around where are we going? Where are we now? You know, what's going on? And do I have any recommendations? So we know inflation increases asset values. Right. So you can see it, the government printed a ton of money, trillions of dollars in the last couple of years, and asset values have gone through the roof, whether it's real estate or stock portfolios or whatever. We know that governments want inflation. And if you're uncertain about that, look up the term financial repression. That is basically governments purposely creating inflation. And you know, even the Fed here in the US has always wanted or targeted 2-3% inflation. Like they come right out and say, we want to target 2-3% inflation. What that means is they're eroding our dollars by 2-3%. And one of the reasons they wanted to do that is because the government owes a lot of money, has a lot of debt. And by eroding the dollar value, it means it's eroding how much the debt is worth. So they can pay it back in dollars that are worth less. And they measure inflation by CPI. So CPI of 7%, which is our last reading, is the highest since 1981. So inflation is absolutely here. It's also a little comical because not everybody believes in the CPI. They think the real inflation rate might be more like 10 or even 12, 15%. They keep changing the way they measure CPI. I think if you measured it based on like how they did it in the 90s, it would be around that 12 to 15%. So inflation is much higher than anybody wants. The Fed says it's going to raise rates, interest rates, four times in 2022, 250 basis points each, so a quarter of a percentage. And now they're even talking about doing it even faster. So they have to do something because when inflation gets away from us or from the Fed, it impacts lower income, middle income people the most. And those are the people that are going to base their votes on, you know, how they're doing in the economy. Not all of them, but that is a big deciding factor. So, you know, whoever is in office, doesn't matter if it's Trump, Biden, Bush, you know, Clinton, it's all about the economy. And so they don't want to hurt the lower and middle class. They need to do something about inflation. So they're going to raise rates. That's clear. It's going to happen. When they raise rates, what they're really doing is hurting the stock market. They're trying to slow it down. There's a huge wealth effect. When the stock market goes up, people feel rich. They actually have a lot more money, at least on paper, and they run out and buy houses and, you know, upgrade their living conditions, buy that new washer dryer. It causes inflation in the market, in the economy in general. They go out to eat a lot more, et cetera. So one of the ways to take care of this is you raise interest rates. Now the 500 companies in the Fortune 500 or the S&P 500, all those companies have a higher cost of debt to run their business. And that starts to slow things down a bit because they're not going to grow their companies as much. Stock market kind of moderates a bit. When the stock market moderates or comes down, the wealth effect is smaller. So now I don't feel as rich and I'm not spending as much. And that should get inflation under control. So that's what's going on here. So we're going to see a lot of volatility and flattening of the stock market. Probably a good amount of losses here, at least for the short term. And again, talk to your financial advisor. They'll tell you, just ride it out. And hopefully it's short, like it was, you know, right after 2008. That was a bit of a long period, but it wasn't 15 years, right? Maybe, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 years. Maybe it's only like Corona, where it was six months to a year and things came roaring back. Who knows what it's going to be, but expect something for sure. What does it mean for real estate? Loan rates are going to increase. So if we have a short-term loan or a interest-only loan, it's going to cost more to operate that property. If you have a long-term fixed-rate loan, which is what we have on 99% of our, actually all of our properties at the moment, are long-term fixed-rate loans. So if you have a 5-year loan, doesn't matter what the interest rates are doing, we're locked in and we're cash flowing and totally protected. So if we've cash flow at 8, 9, 10% on property today, it will not be affected at all by interest rates. The sale price, that will be impacted because just like homes, the amount somebody can buy is based on how much they can get for debt and what the interest is on that debt. So the higher the debt, the less they can afford at the property level. So that does impact, but it's not a one-for-one relationship. In the housing market, there's a huge impact, residential real estate, with rates going up. On the commercial side, there is an impact, but it's not nearly as much. But it will happen. You know, it will put pressure on the market, on real estate prices, both residential and commercial. These small rate hikes aren't going to stop that short-term inflation, though. Rents continue to grow. It's going to take time for the rate hikes to really affect that. So we expect rents will grow for the rest of this year. We also expect forced appreciation, like I was talking about earlier. That's still going to happen no matter what. So that's an offset to anything that happens in terms of interest rates. When you're exiting a deal and you've added millions of dollars of value, you force that equity. Even if interest rates are higher, you're still going to make a profit. I should probably say on this, the fact that the sale prices may go down a bit, that's based on a cap rate. So what I was saying earlier, that you can take the net operating income and multiply it by 20, and that gives you the value of the property. That's, you know, the language used in the commercial real estate world is called cap rates. So a cap rate of 5% is the same as a 20 multiple. So that's why I had cap rates there. So when cap rates go up, then that multiple starts to come down. It's an inverse relationship. I won't get into all the details there, but what I want to say there is people that have been in the market for a while, people that have, you know, good business coaches that lean on their friends who have experience, who have been through market down cycles, they know that cap rates are going up, or that the value of real estate is going to come down to some degree. So when they're looking at new properties to buy today, they're already factoring that in. They're saying, okay, maybe I don't get a 5x return. Maybe it's only a 4.5x whatever on that value add that I did. So they're going to factor all that into their underwriting. And if the deal doesn't make sense, if the price is too high, they have to go back and negotiate the price, or they just don't buy the deal. So it's all factored in at this point, as long as you're working with people that actually know what they're doing. So my investment strategy, work with experienced investors, especially through these turbulent times. Invest in value add projects with forced appreciation, because that literally covers up a lot of the damage that any interest rates or volatility in the stock market will do. And then always invest in markets with growing population, with, you know, where the jobs are going. So if you look at Texas and Georgia, for example, there are a lot of people moving out of California, out of the Midwest, out of the North. They're all heading to these southern markets where it's warmer, where there's a better business environment, where all the jobs are being grown. The job growth in the South is like double that of most of the rest of the country. Same with population. The population growth rate is insane. And the income levels are higher there, right? So people's actual incomes are growing. So with all those people moving there, it puts an upward demand on the apartment units. So the more demand there is for apartment units, the more the prices go up, right? Simple supply and demand. So the rents in these markets are already growing faster than the rest of the country, and we expect that they will continue to do so. And just checking on time here. So I'm going to take like 2 minutes on this. Let's zoom down to the bottom real quick, just because I showed it earlier. So the cash flow quadrant, I now have zero W-2 income or employee income, which makes it tough for me to get a personal loan because the banks only want to work with employees. Even though I've doubled my income and I'm in a much more secure place, it doesn't matter. They have this certain underwriting. So if you plan on leaving your job, you know, get your loans figured out first on your refi for your home. But I'm also now partly self-employed, partly business owner, because I have a lot of people that do work for me and with me on these properties to make sure that everything's going well, like the property management companies that we've hired. And then I've got a good amount of my income coming from investments that when I put money back into my own deals. So employee is zero. The ultimate goal here is 5 years from now, maybe I slow down on the self-employment part. And it's mostly as a business owner and investor. Ultimately, it's just all sitting back and letting my money do the work. The takeaways, let me see if there's anything here that's not completely clear. So we talked about, across different asset classes. So, getting a bit of real estate, maybe a bit of cryptocurrency or oil or whatever, but whatever you're comfortable with, not just having everything in the stock market. Knowledge is power. So if you have the curiosity and the willingness to self-educate, you can learn about all kinds of different investments, which is why you're on this call today. Keep doing that so that you get comfortable and you're able to go and make sound decisions. We talked about investing with proven investors. You can grow your risk tolerance. So the more wins you have. So I was lucky. My early investments were home runs. And so I got very excited about it and I went all in, and it's paid off very well for me. If those first ones didn't go as well, I probably wouldn't have felt so good about putting so much money in. I would have been a bit slower to put all my money into real estate or even half of it. So I did get a little bit lucky there early on, but definitely, take those baby steps and start growing your risk tolerance. Position sizing, that's the more you believe in something, the more money you should put into it. But again, you have to already understand it and know what you're doing. And part of that comes by taking those first few steps. Invest with the wind at your back. Those are the trends, right? Investing in the South where there's population growth, et cetera. And then real estate has excellent tax advantages. So if you make 25% or 20% return and you're paying half as much taxes as you would if you were investing in the stock market, then that return is more like a 30% return versus a 20% in the stock market. So make sure you're comparing apples to apples and look at your tax situation. And that concludes the slide deck. I know I went through that stuff pretty quickly. Totally open for conversation, for any questions. I guess, Julie, how do you want to handle the muting and unmuting?
Yeah, well, we have two questions let's tackle first that are in the chat box. And then after that, if you have questions, please just feel free to unmute yourself and, you know, ask your question. So the first question was, what's the average hold time going back to the beginning of your journey? What was the average hold time of those passive investments?
Majority of them were like 3 years. I would say like that's kind of the average. A few of them went a bit longer. A bunch of them, you know, were done in 2 years. Certainly on the private lending, that was more like a 1 year hold, but on the multifamily stuff, it was, you know, call it, you know, 3 years ish.
Awesome. I'm going to add to that question to the future as to hold times that you're looking at with your offerings for the future.
Yeah. That's a good point. So in our offerings, and most of the time, I, you know, pretty much all the offerings I see from people that I've invested with and others, generally we like to say, expect this to be a 5 year hold. And if the market is still cruising along and everything looks wonderful, or even if we have a hiccup now because the Fed's raising rates, and maybe 2 or 3 years from now we're kind of back to everything being rosy, you know, if things look great in 3 years, we're going to sell it. Like, you know, take the bird in hand, we can just redeploy it to more more properties. If the market's not so great in 2 to 3 years, then, you know, we've got a 7 year loan most of the time on these properties. We can just cash flow for the fourth year, the fifth year, even in 6 and 7, if we have to. So we always tell people, expect, you know, plus or minus 5 years and you should be covered.
Excellent. Thank you. I think that's an important question. Is there a typical grace period to when a passive investor will start seeing cash flow? 4 to 6 months, a year, tomorrow?
Yeah. So some properties, it's literally tomorrow. We buy them already cash flowing. Most of our properties cash flow right out of the gate. So what we tell people is we need a few months to get in there, to get our management in place, to get our feet under us at the property. And we start a month before we even close on the property. So what we say is at the end of the first quarter of operations, first few months of operations, we're going to start distributions. And we'll do monthly distributions at that point.
Fantastic. And you just said monthly versus quarterly.
Yeah, everyone's moving to monthly. That started with Grant Cardone, I think, and he was making such a big deal. Like, he was the only one who does monthly. So everybody kind of followed suit because they didn't want to be the only ones, you know, left out. So now we're doing monthly. As a passive investor, it's actually more annoying to me to get paid monthly. I don't need, you know, I'm not living month to month. So I'd rather just open up my bank account once a quarter and see that everything has hit my bank account, rather than having to go back 3 months to make sure all the payments are there. So it's a bit more tedious, but either way, the money just magically appears in your bank account, which is wonderful.
It's the best thing if you're not passively invested. I get quarterly distributions and I absolutely love it. I'm like, oh, look at that chunk of money that's there. This is great. Right. Next question. Did you pull your money out of your 401k and put it into a self-directed IRA?
I did. Yep. So the first thing I did, I was still an employee at the time, and I opened up a self-directed IRA, which is just an IRA company that allows you to invest in real estate. The IRS is totally fine with it, but Fidelity and others, like, you know, brokerage houses, aren't going to let you put money into real estate because they can't offer that. Like, that's just not what they're set up to do. It's not because the IRS won't allow it. So the first thing I did was open up the self-directed IRA. I moved $50,000 out of Fidelity, and I invested that $50,000 in a passive investment. And then when I saw that that was going well, I did it again, another $50,000. And eventually I just moved it all over. Since then, when I started my own business, I went and opened up a solo 401k, or some people call it a QRP. And I was able to now invest without the help of the IRA company. So I can self-direct it all myself. I can write the checks. I can collect the cash flows and not have that intermediary in the middle.
That's absolutely huge. It's very simple to transfer that over. That's something that I chose to do as well. And the QRP, there's like Damien Lupo, he has the EQRP. It comes by a whole lot of different names. And so, you know, It's a similar thing. And if I have a chance, yeah, I'll drop a couple podcast episodes that explain that, one with Damien Lupo and one with Matt Sorensen, just to help some of you kind of expand on that concept. But I will just assure you, in my experience, it was very simple. And I love that I have direct access. It's just like going on to online banking and wiring the money. It's very, very simple. And you're in control.
Couple of more names there. So there's one called mysolo401k.com. I think if you go to that, there's a lot of educational materials, whether you go with them or not, doesn't matter. You can just get some quick education there. There's another one called Advanta IRA. They're one of the ones that, you know, I've got several friends who use them and they absolutely love them. On the receiving side, so for me as a sponsor, taking those funds in and working with the IRA company, they've also been probably hands down the best one, other than the people who've gone and gotten the EQRP or the solo 401ks. Those are even more, you know, easier to work with, less red tape.
Yeah, the lack of red tape is absolutely fantastic. And you are also, like Steve was mentioning, really diversifying. So I've used my, you know, self-directed funds to diversify into crypto and other things. So you can use that in a variety of ways as well. Which strategies have you found to be most successful in forcing appreciation, specifically on properties that are Class A or B at the time of acquisition?
So absolutely the, you know, value add, forcing the appreciation, that's where it's always been the most lucrative. I also feel it's the safest. Again, as long as you're doing it with the right person who's done this before and they have a realistic business plan. But the business plan of, I'm going to buy something in Cleveland, Ohio, where there isn't a lot of appreciation, there's no population growth, but it cash flows. So you can buy that property in Cleveland and just cash flow. That's great. But when interest rates go up, it's gonna harm the exit price and you're not gonna make as much money. With population shrinkage in general, they're gonna keep losing population. There'll be fewer people to live in that place. So, you know, that's a straight cash flow play. That's fine. But investing for forced appreciation and in growing markets, if you're doing it with the right person, again, with the right business plan, like if they're not saying crazy things like we're going to grow rents at 10% for the next 10 years, you know, there are some insane people out there doing crazy things. Sure, rents may increase by 10% per year. We put in our underwriting that they'll grow by 3%. And that's, you know, most of us that do a good job at this. I know, Julie, you're doing the same thing. You know, in San Antonio, we know rents grew 21% last year, or 23% actually. But we had it set at 3% because you don't know how long that's going to last. And that to me is just gravy. Like the deal has to make sense at 3%.
Love it. Love it. Absolutely true. Somebody's asking, Laura, you're asking about a recommendation on a CPA who understands EQRP, self-directed funds, 401 concept. I'll turn that to Steve in just a moment. I'm pulling up a podcast episode with a real estate CPA. He has a really vibrant YouTube channel as well. He works with larger portfolios, but you'd be able to gain a lot of information. And Steve, you probably have somebody that would work with anybody.
I did. I'm actually trying to find the name of the company now. So let me see here. All right. So there's a company, it's MRM. So M like mother, R M like mother, C P A S like Sam, MRMCPAS.com. It's actually a woman who's invested with me. She works there. Through my conversations with her, I'm like, wow, she's a CPA. She really gets it. And she does the taxes for people who, like me, are sponsors of real estate, as well as people that are passive investors. So she sees it from both sides. She understands it inside and out. Amazing. I'm probably going to move my taxes to her next year. Haven't done it yet. There is another one out of Texas, and this is all, you know, it's federal law for the most part. And anyone who does taxes at the federal level, they can just plug in the state that you're in and it'll also populate the state stuff. The other one name, eludes me at the moment. I'll remember here in the next minute or so.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was pulling up something else, but was that MRM CPA?
MRM. Yeah, I can actually put this in the chat. I forgot I wasn't sharing my screen and presenting anymore.
Okay. Actually, wait, I think I've got it pulled up here. So fantastic. Somebody's wondering, hey, what's her name? Can we name drop?
Deb Pritchard. I haven't asked her if that's okay for me to give her more clients. I'm sure she's going to be fine with it, but...
She's fantastic.
Don't tell her I sent you, just in case.
she would be fine. I'm like, she'd be fine with that. Okay, fantastic. Let's see if there are any. Do your syndications allow for 1031 exchange funds? That's a great question.
So in the last deal that we closed end of last year, we had two 1031s come in at about $500,000 and one came in at $1 million. So what we do there is we take the property and we create a tenant in common structure. So if the property is, say, it's so big, we take a little sliver of that and we say, okay, that's the tenant in common. And that's going to be the part that the 1031 owns. And so they come in completely separately owning that part, and then we syndicate the rest of it. And so when we sell that property down the road, you know, again, 3-4 years later, 5 years later, that tenant in common slice is just like its own property. So that person can then 1031 again from there to another deal. And it costs about $5,000 in fees with your, with all the legal fees for us to get that done.
So that's a great question. And that I'm glad you added that detail right there. And that's so... Not all syndications will receive 1031 funds. So would you like to elaborate on that?
I am so sorry. I just had a call from my son who I'm supposed to be taking to the airport. And he's like, hey, can you come get me?
yeah.
I do have a few more minutes. I don't know why he's calling me so early. But what was the question?
He's excited.
He is excited.
So that's great. I'd be excited too, taking this trip. Okay. So the question is, not all real estate syndications will receive 1031 funds.
Not all. True.
Not all. And so, I mean, I was about ready to elaborate, but you're the star of the show. So I'm going to
There's, thank you. There's a lot of sponsors that won't take it at all because it is complicated. It does create a wrinkle in things. And 1031 intermediaries aren't always easy to deal with. And sometimes you don't close your property in time. So there's a lot of timing issues as well. And then the other is a lot of people will say, because of the legal fees and the hassle, I'm not going to consider bringing it into our deal unless it's at least $1 million, right? Then it starts to become worth it. But if it's a few hundred thousand, they're like, that's like a phone call. I just call one person and they'll write a check for $200,000. So some people just won't do it, and others, it depends on the size and timing.
All right. How about velocity cap specifically? Is there a certain amount that you guys are looking for to receive 1031 or?
If it's a single 1031, like we like it to be closer to $1 million. On that last deal, we had the $1 million 1031. And at that point, now that we're working with the attorneys and we're complicating things anyway, when the other people came with the 500 and the 600, we're like, fine, that's all good. Let's just take care of everybody.
Lump it all together. That is fantastic. Steve, this has been absolutely fantastic. If you have any final questions, this is like the last moment you can possibly ask that question. I just want to thank everybody for showing up. But, you're not going to find this level of transparency. And a lot of people will share their real estate journey, but not in this fine detail as to here's what my portfolio looked like. Here are the shifts that I made. And so, Steve, thank you so much for this powerful presentation, for the transparency. I know that this is what a lot of people are craving, and like, dang, powerful delivery. If you loved it, make sure you head over to Velocity Cap. Did you drop your website link in there just to make it easy? Make sure you head over, check out what Steve has going on. And are there any other ways you'd like people to connect with you?
The website's probably the easiest. I am on LinkedIn and Facebook and all those things as well, but, velocitycap.com.
Awesome. I am grateful for each of you. If we are not already connected, what's up with that? So please make sure you head over to juliehawley.com. Make sure we're connected there and over on LinkedIn, which is my favorite social platform ever. You can also check out the Conscious Investor podcast, which there's a link directly to Brandon Hall, Real Estate CPA. And that will really support a lot of you who are making that transition. Regardless of where you're at, if you are passive, if you're active, or if you're aiming to become a real estate professional, we have three specific segments dedicated to each of those roles so that you can see what the tax implications are and how to be strategic in that. But as Steve mentioned, Deb Pritchard is absolutely amazing. So I would highly recommend connecting up with her company. She's got lots of people there. She can handle it. She can absolutely handle it. If you are going to the Best Ever Conference next week, I know a few of you in here are, but if you're headed there, please make sure that you that we connect up and that we say hi in person, because there's nothing better than meeting people face to face. All right. Final thing is, this came about, this learning session came about because of a simple question that one of my investors asked. So if you are looking and you have a question and you're like, I really want to hear someone speak on that, I don't do regular meetup. I do it question-based so that I can really know that I'm adding value to people. And I find people that I know, like, and trust to deliver the highest quality information. So please reach out to me if you do have one of those burning questions that you really want to hear the answer to. All right. Until next time, everybody, happy investing. Thanks again, Steve.
A lot of people missed out on my recent offering because they simply weren't on my investor list. Being on my newsletter list won't provide you with access to the deals I have. This is because 506B regulations require you and I actually discuss your investment goals before I can show you the deals I have. If you're on the fence about investing in apartments, schedule a call today at 3keysinvestments.com. If you think you're new, so you don't want to be on an investor list, you're missing out on opportunities to refine your ability to review offerings because you simply will never see them. So head over to 3keysinvestments and schedule a call. Live big, love bigger.